This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Geht es Ihnen nicht auch auf die Nerven, wenn ein Unternehmen mit all seinen Auszeichnungen prahlt? Uns auch. Fühlt sich so aufgesetzt an, oder? Mit uns von Kapital.com können Sie sich also wieder Ihrem Podcast widmen. Übrigens haben wir bei den 2024 Online Money Awards die Auszeichnung Best Overall Trading Plattform erhalten. Oh, ups. Kapital.com. Viel besser in Sachen Trading als in Sachen Werbung. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld. Der Handel an den Weltfinanzmärkten ist nicht einfach. Doch nur weil der Handel etwas schwierig sein kann, heißt das nicht, dass Ihr Broker es auch sein muss. Bei Kapital.com möchten wir Ihnen den Handel so einfach wie möglich machen. Ganz gleich, ob Sie ein Konto eröffnen oder eine Position auf unserer übersichtlichen, benutzerfreundlichen Plattform eröffnen möchten. Schauen Sie noch heute bei Kapital.com vorbei und finden Sie heraus, wie wir Ihnen helfen können, intelligenter zu handeln. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the World Service of the BBC. This is Owen Bennett-Jones. Now, when a US president speaks, the world hears him, and that's certainly the case with remarks Donald Trump made on Air Force One last night. He was talking about the people who live in the Gaza Strip. And before assessing the significance of what he said and getting reaction to it, let's just hear his words.
I'd like Egypt to take people and I'd like Jordan to take people. You're talking about probably 1.5 million people. We just clean out that whole thing, and I don't know, it's something has to happen. It's literally a demolition site right now. Almost everything's demolished and people are dying there. So I'd rather get involved with some of the Arab nations and build housing at a different location where they can maybe live in peace for a change. It could be temporarily, could be long term.
Well, that suggests the long-standing commitment to two states, already rejected by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is at the very least being significantly revised by the United States. It is an issue that goes back centuries, but if you take the starting point as the creation of the State of Israel, then according to the UN, the displacement of Palestinians from land that was to become Israel turned 700,000 Palestinians into refugees at that time. Currently, there are more than 2 million UNRWA-registered Palestine refugees in Jordan. That's the country that hosts the largest number. And some of them are descendants of those who fled from or were forced from their homes in the conflict surrounding the formation of Israel. And as of March 23, UNRWA estimated no more than 250,000 Palestine refugees in Lebanon. And today, they say, around 5.9 million Palestine refugees are eligible for UNRWA services worldwide. Well, Nick Beek is in Jerusalem for us. Are you Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, actually, Nick?
I'm in Jerusalem, Owen,
Jerusalem,
today.
Yeah. So what's the reaction you've been hearing to this statement by Donald Trump?
Well, prominent far-right politicians here in Israel are absolutely delighted by his comments, and they've been busy tweeting over the past few hours saying that this is exactly what they want to hear. Among them, the finance minister, Smotrich, he's saying that this is the way forward. Also, the former security minister, Itamar Ben-Gavir, who only recently left the government because he was angry about the ceasefire deal and the prospect of lots of Palestinian prisoners being released, he said this is it's fantastic news that the new president is talking his sort of language. And this is something, of course, that these far-right politicians have been talking about for a long time now. Ultimately, they would like to see Jewish settlers move into Gaza and setting up homes there.
Are there any people in the Israeli politics saying this is not a good idea?
Well, I think the most vocal response today, as far as we can see so far, has been a Hamas official on the political branch of Hamas telling the BBC that this is completely unacceptable and that Hamas will continue to oppose any sort of plan for the displacement of Palestinians from Gaza. And that, in fact, when it comes to reconstructing the Strip, it's Palestinians who must be front and centre of that, and being forced out is simply not acceptable. So that's been the Hamas response in the last hour or so.
Right. And is there a sense that this just came as a total surprise in Israel, or were people expecting it a bit? Mm.
Well, I think, like all of us, we're waiting to see the policy that President Trump fleshes out. He is obviously engaged and thinking about the Middle East, because earlier in the week he was asked about Gaza and he described it as being a place near the sea with the best weather. He said it's a phenomenal location. So really he was talking about it then in terms of being prime real estate. His comments overnight, and we heard them there, he suggests that it's a demolition site, it's over, that it should be cleaned out. But I think it was quite telling that when he was asked, is this a temporary solution as you see it, Mr. President, or a more permanent thing, he said, well, either could be applicable. So I think people are trying to work out whether this is something that the president's musing out loud or whether he has got clear plans here. Certainly, I think Palestinians and others have been concerned about his choice of US ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, who has said previously that he's against a two-state solution, so the creation of a Palestinian state, and also has talked about the Jewish settlers in the West Bank having a biblical right to be there. So I think people are waiting to see what happens, but also maybe Palestinians may be thinking about a bigger picture and maybe a deal that Mr. Trump is envisaging here with Saudi Arabia, and clearly the Saudis wouldn't countenance this.
Thank you very much indeed. That was Nick Beek in Jerusalem there, BBC correspondent. So some reaction from Gaza now. Hada Al-Khud is a journalist in Deir al-Bala at the moment in central Gaza. All her grandparents, then in their 40s, left their home in near the city of Ashkelon in Israel back in 48. Does she fear something similar might happen to her family again?
77 years ago, my grandfathers, they moved from a town outside of Gaza Strip and they stayed in north of Gaza. And this will be repeated again, as Donald Trump said. But I think people of Gaza, they are aware now of what's happening in 1948. And I don't think people will accept to leave Gaza for a long-term period. They will struggle to live under difficult circumstances because they already been displaced for more than 15 months, living in makeshift tents, living in shelters, living in the street even, in destroyed houses. So the mentality of the Palestinian people here in Gaza will prefer to stay in this land rather than to leave. I mean, not all of them, maybe some of them, they will leave Gaza like for personal interest, but most of the people here, they are poor people, they are suffering from difficult circumstances, and maybe they will not be able to live outside of Gaza. They will not be able to adopt in Arab or foreign countries. They are attached to the land of Gaza and will not accept this.
Yeah, but President Trump says that Gaza is virtually destroyed and it may be better for people to move out so they can live somewhere else in peace.
We know like most of Gaza City, most of them, like north, even in south in Rafah, it's all destroyed. No facilities, no services, no infrastructures, no water, no electricity. And maybe when the humanitarian aid will not enter as usual and will not be enough for the people to live, maybe some of the people, they will leave Gaza. But not as Donald Trump said, he was talking about 1.5 million of people. It means like 500,000, they will stay in Gaza. It means that Gaza will be empty from people. So with the delaying in reconstruction, maybe people will be forced or they will rethink again. But for this moment, they just want to live in their home.
And just on your immediate situation, you're in central Gaza trying to get to your children in north Gaza, and that's been delayed because of this dispute over the sequencing of the hostage releases, and a civilian female who's been still held in captivity apparently will be released next week. So are you thinking you will get home next week?
Well, before our call now, I was calling my eldest daughter and she was telling me, why you are not on the checkpoint? Why you are not coming today? And I had to explain for her. She's only 12 years old and she cannot understand the political situation. She thinks that the crossing will open and I will be back like as soon as possible. I told her I will come back, but not this day or the next day. But I'm waiting the moment of returning. I'll have to walk more than 10 kilometers during one day to go back to north and to see my daughters. And I'm waiting for this moment. I was waiting it for more than 15 months. And I will not, at least for the moment, I will not think about what Donald Trump is saying. I'm thinking of my daughters and going back home to live with my daughters, hang them and living with them on Gaza Strip land.
And that's Gada Al-Qud now in central Gaza. Well, let's get some Arab League reaction now. Gamal Rushdie is its spokesperson, and I asked him what he made of Donald Trump's comments.
As a spokesperson for the Secretary General of the Arab League, of course, we have a policy and positions categorically against what Mr. Trump declared. We are against the replacement of Palestinians from the Palestinian land, and we consider this against the notion of a two-state solution and the notion of an independent Palestinian state.
Do you have the power to enforce your views?
Of course, these positions by Mr. Trump are kind of a new American position. We need some deliberations among the Arab countries in order to see how to respond to this new policy, because it goes against the long-standing American position on this two-state solution.
Now, it might help if the members of your organization were willing to help to reconstruct Gaza, are they?
Of course, the reconstruction of Gaza is a key objective by the Arab countries, the Palestinians, and even the international community. But this is completely disconnected from what Mr. Trump has declared. Those are two different subjects. To reconstruct Gaza is an imperative, it's a necessity. But to replace the Palestinians from Gaza, it's a completely different policy.
Well, yeah, but
it goes against the two-state solution.
He linked them. I mean, he said that Gaza is such a... the destruction is so widespread that people should leave and get a better life elsewhere.
The construction is widespread, true, is widespread, and it has to be dealt with, it has to be addressed. But this does not mean that we replace the Palestinians permanently from Gaza. Mind you that the Palestinians' presence on their own land is key to their cause. Removing them or replacing them is tantamount to undermining the Palestinian cause completely.
But we spoke to someone in Gaza who said that while many will want to remain there, some may want to leave.
I would understand this, of course, in light of the level of the unprecedented level of destruction in Gaza. I don't think that we should give Israel a prize after 15 months of destruction by removing the Gazans out of Gaza. That would be kind of realizing the right wing, the Israeli right wing dream.
Well, but let me just put this to you, that Hamas has made clear that it wants to continue its campaign. I mean, it's given no sign whatsoever of backing down. And the prospect is for continued conflict between Hamas and Israel, and many of the Palestinians suffer while that happens. So maybe the time has come for radical change.
This is true, of course, and the radical change we are all working for, the radical change we aspire to, is an irreversible path to an independent Palestinian state. That is the only radical change that could make the Palestinians safe, Israelis safe, and peace prevail in the region.
One last question to you. You speak for the Arab League. It is widely considered to be a highly ineffective organization that has failed to deliver on its pledges and its mission statement, as it were. Does the weakness of the Arab League contribute to the problems in the Middle East?
Highly ineffective, that is... I'm not sure that this is the right way to describe the Arab League as an organization. It's a political organization. It means that the Arab League is trying to reach the consensus voice between Arab countries on issues, on main issues.
Former Egyptian diplomat there and currently the spokesperson of the Arab League, Gamal Rushdie. Coming up a little later in the programme, Sir Paul McCartney, former Beatle, on how AI will affect the ability of musicians to make a living.
AI is a great thing, but it shouldn't rip creative people off. There's no sense in that. Why would a government want to do that? I don't get it. So, if you're putting through a bill, make sure you protect the creative thinkers, the creative artists, or you're not going to have them.
And some headlines. Palestinians have expressed shock after President Trump suggested most of Gaza's population should be moved to other Arab countries. Lebanon says at least 11 people have been killed by Israeli fire as thousands tried to return to their homes in the south. and the Congolese authorities have blocked access to the airport in Goma as rebels advance on the city. You're listening to NewsHour. The struggle between the Army of the Democratic Republic of Congo and M23 rebels is intensifying, and the fighting getting ever closer to the city of Goma in the east of DRC. The UN Security Council has been summoned for an emergency meeting later today to discuss the situation. And in the last few days, 13 foreign soldiers serving with peacekeeping forces are amongst hundreds killed in the fighting. Well, the Anglican Bishop of Goma, Martin Gordon, left the city yesterday. Speaking from neighbouring Rwanda, he explained why he'd done that.
As we left yesterday over the border, we did see a lot of expatriates on their way out, particularly, I think, for all those we know with children in Goma, decided yesterday that that was the day that they should go. Just as a measure of caution that we don't know how everything is going to pan out. And every morning we were waking up to the sound of bombs.
Well, let's hear now from the journalist and writer Michaela Wrong. She's very knowledgeable about the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. She's worked for the Financial Times and Reuters, written books. And I asked her, is there anything the international community can do to help end the hostilities in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
We have been here before. We were here in 2012 when the M23 in a previous iteration actually went into Goma. At that stage, what happened is there was a big flurry of alarm on the part of the international community. And very abruptly, very suddenly, all Western aid to Rwanda was cut off. And $240 million worth at least of aid was suddenly halted. The World Bank was involved with that, so was the IMF. And it's had a really dramatic and very beneficial impact because Rwanda, people tend to forget that Rwanda is very heavily aid dependent. And so if it faces an aid boycott by its closest allies, it really has to react to that. And I think what's been really baffling and puzzling and confounding to analysts and people like me is why the international community hasn't done anything approaching that this time around when we've seen the similar build-up and similar levels of violence.
Even if you're baffled, can you try and explain why the donor countries are not trying to rein Rwanda in?
So many of these governments have interests now. And so what you saw here in Britain is during the entire period when we had the Conservative government here was hoping to send illegal migrants to Rwanda, have them processed in Rwanda and stay there. There was no way the British government was going to utter a word of criticism of what Rwanda was doing in Congo. Similarly, France is very beholden to Rwanda because Rwandan troops have deployed in Mozambique, where there's a major, massive liquefied gas installation owned by Total, and they have brought peace to that region, and France is very grateful for that. And the states have been deeply critical, deeply increasingly critical of what Paul Kagame is doing inside Congo. But the States is otherwise preoccupied, as we know right now, you know, with the incoming Trump administration. And then, you know, its focus is really on Ukraine and Gaza. So Congo comes very low down on this list.
If the Rwandan-backed forces, M23, do take Goma, what will that mean? What will happen? And what will it be like in Goma?
Well, Goma is a major hub. It's really the key hub in the Kivus. There's a major airport there. It's where all the NGOs are based. It's where the flights go in, where, you know, the UN, MONUSCO, the UN force has an important headquarters there. But I think people are looking at this as something much bigger than just the fall of Goma. People are anticipating, the analysts I speak to are sort of saying Goma will be first, Bukavu, which is the southern capital, will be next. And what they are saying to me is that they have gone from thinking that the M23, which was seen for years as just Kagame's way of kind of keeping leverage over DRC and also keeping a sort of claim on the minerals that are smuggled out of that part of DRC, that now there's a different agenda, that the M23 is actually going to bring about the de facto annexation of North and South Kivu.
And that's the analysis of journalist and Congo expert Michaela Wrong there. The former Beatle, Sir Paul McCartney, has told the BBC that proposed changes to copyright law could make it impossible for musicians and artists to make a living. AI developers want to use all the content that's out there on the internet, text and music, to generate their projects and profits. But that overlooks the fact that, as things stand, people own that content. They have copyright over what they created. Sir Paul McCartney told his concerns to Laura Koonsberg.
Just worried about the copyrights not being protected, because if it gets a bit like the Wild West, then the people who created these copyrights don't benefit. And I think that takes away a lot of incentive, you know, because when we were kids in Liverpool, we found a job that we loved, but it also paid the bills.
What do you think the risk is for the next generation of musicians coming through?
So, for instance, you get young guys, girls, coming up, and they write a beautiful song, and they don't own it, and they don't have anything to do with it, and anyone who wants can just rip it off. I mean, the truth is, the money's going somewhere. You know, when it gets on the streaming platforms, somebody's getting it, and it should be the person who created it.
And if you hadn't been paid, then maybe the world wouldn't have ever heard Yesterday or Let It Be or Hey Jude.
You know, that is really true, because you like to think of art as the muse. You know, it's just the muse comes to me. It's not like that.
And actually, you used a kind of machine learning technology to help produce the song that you put out last year to, you know, recreate mm-hmm. John Lennon's vocal performance from something from 1970. So what would you say to someone who say, well, you're being a Luddite, you're just, you know, sticking your heels in because you don't like the idea of progress?
Yeah, I get that, you know, and I think AI is great and it can do lots of great things. As you say, you know, we took an old cassette of John's and cleaned his voice up, so it has its uses, but my worry is in this rip-off area. You know, that was John's thing. He was in the Beatles. His widow gave us the tape. So there was no question of sort of copyright. Mm-hmm. But when you get, if you take that and then rip it off. See, for instance, I think I'm on the internet singing God Only Knows by the Beach Boys. But I never sang it. But AI made me sing it. So somebody's getting some sort of payoff there, and it's not me. I'm not interested. But I was talking to someone, and I said, you know, it didn't sound like me, not quite. But to casual observers, it's me singing God Only Knows. But I said to this person, I said, yeah, but, you know, give it 5 years, and it's going to sound exactly like me. And the guy said, one. Give it 1 year. And it's true. It's going so fast that, you know, they're going to be able to put my voice on anything, anybody's voice on anything. So I think you just have to worry about the rip-off. AI is a great thing, but it shouldn't rip creative people off. There's no sense in that. Why would a government want to do that? I don't get it. We're the people. You're the government. You're supposed to protect us. That's your job. So, you know, if you're putting through a bill, make sure you protect the creative thinkers, the creative artists, or you're not going to have them.
As simple as that.
If there's such a thing as a government, it's their responsibility, I would think, to protect the young people, to try and enhance that whole thing so that it works, so that these people have got jobs and can enhance the world with their wonderful art. Mm. So protect it.
There we are. That was Sir Paul McCartney, former Beatle, trying to look after the interests of the next generation of musicians wanting to follow on after him. You're listening to the World Service of the BBC. This is NewsHour.
Geht es Ihnen nicht auch auf die Nerven, wenn ein Unternehmen mit all seinen Auszeichnungen prahlt? Uns auch. Fühlt sich so aufgesetzt an, oder? Mit uns von Kapital.com können Sie sich also wieder Ihrem Podcast widmen. Übrigens haben wir bei den 2024 Online Money Awards die Auszeichnung Best Overall Trading Plattform erhalten. Oh, ups. Kapital.com. Viel besser in Sachen Trading als in Sachen Werbung. CFDs sind mit einem hohen Risiko behaftet. 70% der Anleger verlieren Geld.
And welcome back to NewsHour. Now, there's been a heist in the Netherlands worthy of a movie. There was an explosion and then the thieves were in and out within 3 minutes. And among the stolen items, a golden helmet dating back to 500 BC. And I've been discussing it all with Arthur Brand, an art theft investigator.
When I was alerted, I hoped it would be a painting, you know, because paintings, they will try to sell. And then there is maybe a way for the police or myself to get it back. But these thieves went straight for the most beautiful piece, a golden helmet and 3 golden bracelets. Well, that's the worst case scenario because you can melt down gold or silver. We think that their goal is to melt these treasures down.
Right. And what kind of value would they get from that?
This helmet is priceless. It's world heritage. But if you talk only about the gold, it's not clear how much kilos it is. Maybe it's 1 kilo, 2 kilos. So they will get some tens of thousands of euros out of this. But the stupid thing is, if they get caught, they will not only be prosecuted for theft, but also for destroying cultural heritage.
Will they get caught? I mean, they left a car behind, apparently, and, you know, the whole business of getting access to explosives in Europe is not so easy. So there are some lines of inquiry?
Yes, they left a car, they burned it down. So with that in mind and the explosive use, we think they are professionals. Not so much professional art thieves, but people, criminals who this time targeted a museum, the next time they targeted a bank or whatever. So it's heavy stuff. And in the Netherlands, we have a problem. In the last year, we had 1,200 attacks with explosives. And, you know, that's a big problem. What they are trying to do now is on television and in the newspapers, trying to get as much information, because there's always someone who knows something. And these treasures, you know, it's world heritage. They should not be destroyed. So, and the Dutch police is a very, very professional. And I know from experience that they will not let this go, these criminals. There's no escape for them.
You haven't mentioned CCTV. Would that be an avenue of inquiry?
Yes, these thieves must have been in a museum before. You know, you cannot go in there with a bomb and entering and thinking, where should we go? So there are now police officers watching these clips from the last weeks to see if there is somebody who is not a regular museum visitor. And they say they have footage, and let's hope they will we catch before they can melt this stuff down.
Have you ever met some of these criminals that you chased down and said, look, what are you doing? You're destroying some of the most beautiful objects that exist.
These people don't think like us. They don't see a world heritage. They see a gold bar, they can melt it down. They see a gold bar and they can buy a Mercedes or another car. They don't care. That's not how they think.
And that was the art investigator, Arthur Brand. You're listening to NewsHour. Amidst all the other uncertainty in the Middle East, a 60-day ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah has just come to an end. Under that deal, Israeli troops and Hezbollah fighters were due to have completed their withdrawals from southern Lebanon, and the Lebanese army should now be deployed alongside UN peacekeepers in a 30-kilometre region between Israel's border and the Litani River. Well, Israel and the Lebanese army are blaming each other for non-implementation of the deal. Hezbollah are threatening a return to hostilities. The BBC's Karine Toby joins us from southern Lebanon. Where exactly are you and what is happening around you?
We are in Bint Jbeil, which is just minutes away from one of the villages where, you know, people tried this morning to cross to. These villages are still under Israeli occupation. People, civilians, were expecting that the Israelis would withdraw by today, but they haven't. And so the people decided to go. To try to cross into those villages. They were met by Israeli fire. As we are speaking, there have been around 15 people killed and over 80 people injured due to that fire, as people are still trying to cross into their villages and to force the Israelis out of their country.
I missed you saying how many had been killed in this. How many is it?
15 so
yeah,
far.
Yeah, so it's serious. And are Hezbollah fighters also still in the area?
At the moment, I mean, there is no Hezbollah visible presence in anywhere in southern Lebanon. The Lebanese army has been deploying from every single area the Israelis have been withdrawing from. And this is part of the deal. But the Lebanese army is saying that the Israelis have been stalling their withdrawal from Lebanon, which has led to a delay in a full deployment of the Lebanese army, which cannot enter an area that is under occupation by the Israelis. So basically, at the moment, you can't see any presence for any Hezbollah, you know, fighters. And this has always been the case anyway, because Hezbollah doesn't operate off the ground or isn't, you know, like a regular army. And the Lebanese army is saying that it is fulfilling its part of the deal, but it is the Israelis that are, you know, delaying their withdrawal and therefore preventing it from being all over the place.
So are you saying the Lebanese army are absent from the entire area that's covered by the ceasefire, or just that they're not going into these little areas that the Israelis are still in?
No, they're not into the areas where the Israelis right. are still in.
Yeah. Okay, and so what is Israel saying about what its plans are now?
Well, it doesn't say exactly why it needs to extend its presence in Lebanon. It says that it still have, you know, to conduct some operations. It says that, I mean, the whole point of, you know, everything that has been happening in Lebanon from the point of view of Israel is that it wants to secure the condition for the return of, you know, the residents of northern Israel to Israel safely. And it has been carrying out, since the beginning of this ceasefire 2 months ago, it has been carrying out almost on a daily basis demolition of houses, building homes, even uprooting trees in some places. And it keeps saying that this is part of, you know, its plan to secure that the area has been becoming safe for the return of its, the residents of the north. Of course, in Lebanon, this is seen as, you know, under a completely different light. And there is absolutely no explanation from the Lebanese side why the Israelis aren't withdrawing, what kind of operations they still want to carry, and for how long they want to stay. Because they just said they want to extend their stay. There were reports that they have informed the U.S., which is the guarantor of the deal, that they wanted to extend for 30 days. But this hasn't been confirmed. And so far, everything is in limbo.
Okay, thank you very much, Corinne Toby, BBC correspondent in southern Lebanon. Let's see if we can get any more information about what the various positions of these various parties are from the spokesperson of the UN force in Lebanon, UNIFIL. That is Andrea Tenenti, joins us now. Have you been given any information about how long the Israelis are planning to stay?
Well, according to the agreement, the cessation of hostilities agreement arrangements, today was the last day. So we have no indications on how much longer the IDF will be staying in South Lebanon. This is an issue that now has been dealt by a mechanism that has been created 2 months ago and is chaired by the US and France at the moment. So I understand that the main stakeholders are in conversation right now to try to find solutions. What we are seeing right now is still presence of IDF in several villages in the south of Lebanon, and that of course makes very difficult for the Lebanese army to be able to be redeployed. Today, of course, the escalation of violence is increasing the concerns for deterioration of the situations and also the further escalation. So we are on the ground at the moment together with the Lebanese army to try to de-escalate the tension.
Did you UNIFIL see the incident in which 15 people were killed trying to get back to their villages?
Well, we are on the ground with the Lebanese army at the moment. So we have seen the incidents and reported some of the incidents. Of course, in some of the areas, the presence is only of the Lebanese armies, but we also have been deployed at the request of the Lebanese army across several parts of the area of operation to try to prevent any further escalations. We have seen reports, as your colleague was mentioning, of 14, 15 people being killed and over 80 wounded. However, the management of the crowds, of the civilian remains remains outside our mandate. This is something for the Lebanese army to deal with. We don't have that mandate of dealing with the civilians in South Lebanon.
I think it would help to have some ideas of the numbers involved in all of this. How many UNIFIL personnel are there in southern Lebanon?
In southern Lebanon, at the moment, we have a little bit less than 10,000 troops from 48 different countries. Of course, some of these areas where our contingents are based, they have limited monitoring capabilities because of IDF presence. So it's very difficult to be able to deconflict some of these activities. So we are
10,000 is a lot. I mean, and how many IDF do you estimate are there and Lebanese army?
I don't know how many IDF soldiers. I know that the Lebanese army are redeploying to the south. We are able to go inside the villages where they're left by the IDF and left redeploying. I guess about the Lebanese army, around 1,500, 2,000 troops at the moment, and they're increasing the numbers in order to be fully deployed in all this area. But as I said, IDF are still present in most of the villages and areas along the blue line.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much for giving us your update on what's happening in southern Lebanon. Sounds like a very difficult situation as we move forward. That's Andrea Tenenti there. He is the spokesperson for UNIFIL. You're listening to NewsHour on the World Service of the BBC. Now, tomorrow is International Holocaust Memorial Day, and this year also marks the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the most notorious, probably, of all the Nazi death camps, Auschwitz, in southern Poland. Now, in addition to these camps, the Nazis established many ghettos where they imprisoned large populations of Jews, and one of those was Terezinstadt, which is in Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. Well, Lenka Lichtenberg is a Czech-Canadian singer whose grandmother was actually imprisoned there. And she was able to bring her grandmother's poems, written there in secret during the war, back to the camp some 8 decades on.
We are standing right now in the loft of the Magdeburg Barracks, which is a building in Theresienstadt, or Terezin, that hosted the famous Terezin Cabaret. And it turned itself into a hub of culture and a place to both create new works and escape from reality. My mother, who was between the ages of 14 and 17 when she was here, and my grandmother, Hannah, and her husband, Richard, they were all incarcerated in Terezin for 2.5 years. And I do have a feeling that they would have come here.
Jsme věčně ztraceni, věčně spaseni.
What is this place? Where have we come to?
Za nocí nejtmavších na slunce pamatuj, pamatuj.
Those are words by Anna Hanna Friseva, a Czech poet who was imprisoned in the Nazi ghetto of Terezinstadt, or Terezin as it's known in Czech. Lenka was able to return with the poems of her grandmother, and those poems she set to music. The Nazis infamously created propaganda films at Terezin to give the impression that it was a spa town full of relaxation and culture, using the camp's actual rich cultural life to pretend to the visiting Red Cross that they treated the Jewish inmates well. Peter Rich, a guide at Terezin, describes the reality.
In the first moment when people came here, were brought here, they were split into the two categories, able to work, unable to work. And sad thing is that who didn't work? Sick people, old people, kids. So especially sick people and young kids were sent to extermination camps very often as at first.
Lenka Lichtenberg's grandparents' relationship was broken by the war. Something that is reflected in the poems and in the songs.
My grandfather Richard was arrested by the Gestapo, and he was in prison for 6 months. By the time they were leaving, going actually to Terezín, things were already bad like this. Studený soumrak byl můj milý, když my dva jsme se loučili. They do tell a story so much. You know, why would she be memorizing and adapting a poem about saying goodbye to someone leaving the next morning? That sounds very much to me like that would be her husband. It is a very powerful picture into her world and into her emotions.
For Lenka Lichtenberg, returning to sing her grandmother's poems at Terezín, some 8 decades on, is deeply meaningful.
Finding the poems in her booklets already made everything very real. It's become a part of my life more so than ever before. I have felt that my grandma and my mom have just come back to me, even though they have both passed. Neživé bolesti šťastného
okolí. Music by the Czech-Canadian singer Lenka Lichtenberg there. And I should just say that Tim Franks will be presenting NewsHour from Auschwitz on Monday as world leaders gather to mark this 80th anniversary of the liberation of that Nazi concentration camp. The UN Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, has said some 200,000 refugees have returned to Syria from neighbouring countries since the government of Bashar al-Assad was overthrown last month. Now, in order to make this return sustainable, he says, and to make life better for all Syrians, the economy needs to return, services need to be restored and reinstated, and security needs to be guaranteed. So, how much of any of that is happening? What's it like on the ground now in Syria? Dr. Abdul Karim Egzayez is a medical doctor, and he's just been travelling through the country quite widely. He went back actually for the first time in 9 years. He's based in those 9 years in King's College, London University, and he's in London now. So how long was he in Syria on this trip?
I visited Syria for about 2 weeks. So I've been to 5 different regions in Aleppo, Idlib, Latakia, Homs and Damascus.
And tell us, what did you see? What was it like?
So the whole trip was profound and emotional experience for me. So the last time was in Syria, and the Assad Syria was in February 2013. But basically what struck me the most was the drastic change I observed. So the cities that I knew, basically, I didn't see. So which I had previously known cities for beauties were vastly different. So the 14 years of war and conflict have taken an immense toll of of these cities. So they were thriving cities, but now they are sites of widespread destructions. So basically, I didn't see what I expected to see. So that vibrant atmosphere I remember about these cities have been replaced by signs of exhaustion and despair.
Right. And I know you were focusing particularly on the medical facilities. So what were they like?
Actually, I was trying to compare between northwest of Syria, which was under opposition-controlled areas for the last at least 9-10 years, and the newly liberated areas, or the areas that were under Assad. So the most of the hospitals and most of the institutions in the Assad-controlled areas were completely collapsed. I was really surprised by the level of corruption in these hospitals and institutions, and also the lack of investment. I can't say the lack of investment, actually the absence of any investment in the health sector. So I don't know how patients were receiving services in the last 14 years. If I compare this to Idlib region, to northwest of Syria, I would say the services were much better in terms of the equipment, consumables, supplies, and even in terms of the quality of care and also the availability of different specialties and knowledge. Because northwest of Syria was open to the world, and a lot of diaspora were contributing to the health system there, while in the other areas they were under Assad-controlled, they were very closed
and the whole health system is completely collapsed, I would say.
I guess the issue now is to look forward. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham is in power. I think you were engaging with officials from the new authorities. Have you got any confidence that the kind of problems you're describing will be overcome?
I would say it is really difficult now to look ahead. There are a lot of challenges. While the new leadership, they showed some promising movements towards, you know, hopefully building back better. But I would say the level of challenges we're facing is immense. So now currently the focus is to restore some sort of services across all sectors. And I hope that Syria has a lot of resources in terms of people and also expatriates that are willing to come back to the country to rebuild. And I've seen some level of openness from the new leadership to welcome these contributions. And I've seen, for example, a lot of even women in leadership positions. I've met at least like 9 different women heading major hospitals in different regions, showing really great leadership. With these issues, I think then we might be able to be optimistic that yes, it's a very difficult way to go, but hopefully in a few months, maybe 1-2 years, I think we can build back better.
I mean, I'm surprised to see the UN High Commissioner for Refugees saying 200,000 people have already gone back. And did you see evidence of that?
Yes, I did. So I crossed to Syria from Lebanon, and I've seen a lot of Syrians who were in Lebanon before the 8th of December were crossing the border. And I met some of them, and they said basically now they have hopes that the conditions in Syria will be better. We need to remember that now with the level of destructions, the lack of services, so it might take time, but I see this as happening soon.
And that was Dr. Abdul Karim Exayas, just back from that trip to Syria. One of the stars of Indian classical music took to the stage in London on Saturday night. That is Amjad Ali Khan playing the sarod. It's a stringed instrument, rather like the sitar. And alongside him was the London Philharmonic Orchestra and more than 70 refugees. The Refugee Orchestra project was created in 2016. It's a way to unite musicians and raise funds for those who've had to flee their homes. And my colleague Sean Lay spoke to the founder of the organisation, Lydia Yankovskaya.
When I first collaborated with the Khans, which was now almost a decade ago, I had no background in Indian classical music, and I was actually worried about taking it on. And I said this to them, but as soon as we got into the room together, it didn't matter because we're still expressing our emotions through phrase, through rhythm, through melody. And that is something universal that relates to human beings on a very visceral physical level.
This is a rather more prosaic question, but I'm interested by a lot of people flee. How many, even in fleeing, when they have very little they can take with them, how many will take their instrument?
If they can. All of them. I think for any musician, that ends up being your first priority, your instrument. The few exceptions is we have, for instance, in Refugee Orchestra Project, we have a number of musicians from Afghanistan whose instruments were destroyed by the Taliban. And that, of course, is devastating.
What have the members said to you about the experience of doing that?
In the Refugee Orchestra Project, the amazing thing is that everybody comes from vastly different backgrounds, but they share this experience of having had to leave their homeland, to cut ties with something that they knew. In some cases, coming to a new place and realizing that their homeland as they know it no longer exists. And that shared experience, I think, brings another dimension to the music making.
And that was Lydia Yankovskaya, the founder of the Refugee Orchestra, and she brings us to an end of this edition of the programme. So thanks very much for listening. And from Owen Bennett-Jones here in London, goodbye.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.